Good morning. It is 8:19. I'm Jonathan Reeves, news director with KASU. And joining me on the phone lines right now, we're talking to U.S. Representative Rick Crawford, who joins us here on KASU. And good morning. Welcome back to KASU, Mr. Crawford.
You bet. Good to be with you.
Well, first of all, can you give us an update on what's going on in the House and what you're working on specifically? Kind of give us an update, please.
Well, you know, right now we're doing an awful lot to support the initiative to rein in government regulations. And that's been something that we've tried to do over the last 6-8 years, but obviously the administration didn't agree with that. In fact, the administration was aggressively engaging in regulatory pressure on virtually every industry. So we've decided that that's something that, since we have some support in the White House, we can actually take some of the regulatory pressure off of businesses across the country. So we've been working on that. That's going to continue to be a priority. Obviously, we have a few other items on our plate. Repealing Obamacare is one of them. We've got tax reform is another. Those are some pretty big items. And then, you know, personally for me, obviously, you know that I've been working pretty hard on trying to lift the credit restriction on trade to Cuba. And that's going to continue to be something that we work very hard on. And we've got a real path forward with that. And then we're doing the last stages of preparation for a farm bill, which we hope to address in the fall of this year. So, you know, a lot going on. A lot of it is just some preparatory work, lay the foundation for some legislation that's going to have to take place. But we're working pretty hard.
So let me ask you about a couple of those things real quick. Farm bill, you were talking about that. So for the residents of 1st Congressional District for Arkansas, where a lot of agriculture is grown, what do you want to see in a new farm bill that specifically would help Arkansas farmers?
Well, you know, we've seen, for example, crop insurance that is kind of a one-size-fits-all type of a deal, and there's very little regard for the type of production that we have here in this part of the country, and, you know, particularly as it applies to rice. But because we're so heavily irrigated, that's kind of serves as our crop insurance, as our ability to irrigate. And so we need to adopt some different models because, you know, with the direction that farm policy is headed, you know, there are a whole lot of folks, and we are up against a significant disadvantage numerically, geographically. There are a whole lot of folks that just want to rely exclusively on crop insurance, and that's just not a good, fair policy. It doesn't take into consideration the agriculture production that we have here in the Mid-South and other parts of the country. And when you see what happened, for example, with the Stacks program, ultimately that didn't work well. That shallow loss program that they developed exclusively for cotton didn't really have the desired effect. So we're going to have to do a better job in developing policy that more adequately reflects the needs of folks outside of the Midwest.
Go ahead.
Well, so, you know, crop insurance, it certainly has its place, and there are a lot of folks who use it, but it can be a lot more effectively used, and we need to develop some programs that address not just rice, but, you know, what about specialty crops? There's very little in the way of a risk management tool for specialty crops. And so it's not just that I'm exclusively focused on rice, but in a broader sense around the country where we have produce and, you know, nuts and things of that nature that are specialty crops, they don't have any risk management tools. So we've got to address that not just on the basis of the Mid-South and rice, but also the other foods that are produced that are generally left out of the equation when it comes to risk management.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford joining us. Let's go to the regulation part of this. You were talking about the regulation reform is something that is a priority right now with scaling back some of the regulations. But some of the regulations may be good, some may not so much. I think there are some people who are concerned that if you scale back too much, it may affect you know, environmental safety or other safety. And that, so how do you make that determination of being able to keep things safe and not scaling back too much regulation?
Well, I mean, I think that you certainly have to be respectful of issues like that. I mean, anybody that says that we're not committed to safe drinking water and clean air and things like that, that's just ridiculous to think that we're not. I mean, I have small kids, and I want them to live in a clean environment, a healthy environment. But you can easily go overboard with that. And the example I would give is the waters of the U.S. A gross overreach, way out of the scope of three agencies that were created to regulate virtually every body of water, whatever size, in this country. And the argument being they're all interconnected in some way, so therefore these three agencies had to effectively regulate. I mean, even a ditch running by a roadside, a stock pond, anything, any body of water. What they did was they took the navigable word out of the definition under the Clean Water Act and just said waterways. And that gave them unlimited authority to regulate virtually any body of water that they chose to, provided they could show significant nexus to a regulated waterway. Well, that's a very ambiguous term, and it is subjective and basically comes down to three individuals who could make that determination without any kind of accountability from the legislative body. So what you have is a complete overreach and a misinterpretation of the Clean Water Act. And so we're confident that the waters of the U.S. won't go into effect. It was something that the previous administration was fully committed to, but it would have cost, you know, billions in regulatory costs and compliance costs. And for farmers, it would have been, you know, completely unnecessary. And, you know, the idea that farmers somehow don't care about the land is ludicrous. They are good stewards. They have to be, because they depend on the land for their income and their livelihood. So, you know, putting that kind of pressure and using, you know, what have been historically good partners and putting them in a regulatory role, and those agencies being the National Resources Conservation Service of the USDA and the Corps of Engineers, it's not in their charter to be regulatory agencies. And what WOTUS did, Waters of the U.S., was it brought those two into a regulatory role, and it created somewhat of a what you might call a regulatory triad between EPA or among EPA, NRCS, and Corps of Engineers. And it's just way too much, way overstated, and a gross misinterpretation of the Clean Water Act.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford joining us. Mr. Crawford, we have some listener questions for the next couple of minutes, and we, of course, are very happy to have listener questions here. And if you're a listener and you want to, we'll be letting you know when we have these monthly interviews. And if you would like to submit your questions, you can definitely do so on our Facebook page at KASU Public Radio on Facebook. And we're happy to be able to do that. So let me go ahead and go into a couple of questions for you just for the next couple of minutes. Of course, I know that you've been in support of President Trump's executive order on the temporary travel ban of people from mostly seven Muslim countries, which is receiving some strong pushback. In your opinion, what do you say to those who are against the order, and why do you feel that this order is necessary?
Well, it's much like immigration orders that were issued by previous administrations for much the same reason. For example, you know, President Jimmy Carter issued an order very similar in nature regarding Iran right after, in 1979, right after the Islamic Revolution took place in Iran. And you know, look, the president has a duty to keep our country safe. And if it hurts people's feelings that he is committed to national security, then I think, you know, it's something that we have to risk. Hurt feelings. I would rather risk hurt feelings than risk American lives. And you know, so it may not have been the most articulate expression of that in terms of rolling out the executive order. The Department of Homeland Security had just, General Kelly had just taken control of DHS within a matter of, you know, just a couple of days. We didn't have an attorney general at the time, and he was in a hurry to address that national security threat. And we have overwhelming evidence to indicate that, you know, these refugee populations are being infiltrated for the express purpose of gaining access to not just the United States, but many European countries as well, Western nations, because that is part of their plan to disrupt our economy and to engage in jihad against Western nations. So we know this is the case. So they don't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. They only care that they feel like it's in their interest to disrupt us through terrorist attacks, much like we saw in Orlando and San Bernardino and Nice and other places, New York, New Jersey. And this is going to continue unless and until we get serious about our national security. And I think this president is serious about our national security.
Let's talk about, I know you mentioned earlier about the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. So another question is, what are elected officials doing to preserve equal, meaningful coverage for all constituents, including those with low to moderate income and including those with pre-existing conditions?
Well, you know, what you won't see more than likely is this, you know, a great big plan like you saw with Obamacare. Obamacare was a packaged up in a variety of ways. Certainly there was legislation, there was tax provisions in there, there was administrative latitude through the way that the legislation was written that empowered the Secretary of HHS to implement through rulemaking a lot of different policies. So this was a very overarching, actually overwhelming policy initiative. And if you remember, I mean, it was thousands of pages. Very few people have read it because it's, I mean, it makes War and Peace look like a dime novel. It's so big and all encompassing that very few people read it. And you may recall then Majority Leader, our Speaker, Nancy Pelosi said, well, we have to pass it to find out what's in it. And that just kind of is an indication of what this law is all about. Now, we see that it's been a major burden on businesses. It's hampered job growth. It's hampered economic growth. And it's made it difficult for people to even utilize their health care insurance because it's cost prohibitive in most cases because the deduction of your deductible is so high, your premiums are so high that, you know, you really have to be in pretty dire straits before you can even utilize this health care coverage. And so we owe it to the American people to do a better job. Yes, there are concerns about pre-existing conditions. Those pre-existing condition exclusions largely come because individuals were unable to maintain creditable coverage between employers or over a period of time until such time as they can gain health care, which typically had been historically through employer-based coverage. Well, now we've got this deal where why would you even buy the insurance when if you get sick or get hurt, then you go buy it because that's the way this program is made to work. And that's unfair to everybody involved. But I think that you need to make sure that you've got a provision in there that recognizes that you can't, it's difficult for families to cash flow COBRA, which is under the old system. Typically, that's what you did. You would have to make a determination of how I'm going to maintain my creditable coverage to avoid an exclusion for a pre-existing condition. Well, we want to end that. COBRA benefits were cost prohibitive, and working families had to make a choice about whether or not they pay their mortgage for a period of months or whether or not they maintain their creditable coverage to avoid an exclusion. We can address that. A lot of it can be done through competition and portability and things of that nature. But, you know, look, the other problem is that some states do a better job of administering federal programs than other states do. And so I think we should look to the states as potentially templates for how to do it right and give the states some autonomy in this regard and set up, you know, a competitive marketplace. for example, you know, state-to-state competition. If I want to buy insurance for my car in Alabama, there's no law that says I can't do that. But for healthcare, it's different. And so, you know, when you have a competitive model, you're going to see a higher degree of customer service. You're going to see in a competitive model that, you know, people are more, by nature, they're competing for your business. And so they're going to do more to earn your business and keep your business. And so I think there's some simple things that we can do to address that. But then on the regulatory side, the HHS secretary has broad authority under this law to promulgate rules. And we're going to see that scaled back tremendously under this new HHS secretary, Dr. Tom Price, who was just confirmed. And he'll have the support of the executive branch, obviously, and he'll have the legislative support to make sure that we can roll back the most egregious parts of this law, and that we can work on a solution to drive down costs. And ultimately, that's what this comes down to, is being able to drive down drug costs and insurance costs, because doctors right now are you know, struggling with, you know, the delivery costs are not necessarily that high. It's just that most doctors are practicing defensive medicine, and that's another thing that we need to address, is, you know, the liability that they are under. And so they go overboard in ordering tests, and that increases the cost of delivery.
U.S. Representative Rick Crawford joining us here on KASU. I know we've gone a little long on this segment, but do you have time for one more question, or shall we wrap this up?
Sure, I got time for one more.
Okay, let's do that then real quick. There are some listeners that are very concerned about the funding that goes to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, as well as eliminating the humanities and the arts funding from the federal budget. In light of recent calls to eliminate funding for the CPB, the NEA, and the NEH, what role do you feel the federal government should have in financially supporting the arts and the humanities?
Well, it's easy for us to kind of get caught up in the, you know, the sort of the good feeling that we're supporting the arts and the humanities. But there's lots of private sector support for the arts and humanities, and every other discipline functions in that space, in that commercial space, where they can, you know, fund themselves. Not every other discipline, but you know, it's certainly you know, commercially viable for the arts to function in a marketplace dynamic. If, you know, it's as simple as that. What I don't want to see is taxpayer dollars going to fund the type of art that is shouldn't be funded through taxpayer dollars. If you want to make political statements, you can do that on your own dime, and the taxpayer shouldn't be forced to pay for it. If the Corporation for Public Broadcasting provides a valuable service, but so do all the other radio stations around the country who operate commercially and do it in a way that they sustain themselves based on their own successes or failures, and their ability to sell advertising space. I'm a former broadcaster, and it would have been nice to have received a subsidy, but I didn't. I had to get out and sell ads. I had to develop programming that was marketable in the marketplace, and that listeners wanted, and advertisers saw as valuable medium to reach those listeners. And so I'm a big believer in the free market, and that, you know, commercialization is not an inhibition of free speech. In fact, I think it facilitates free speech. But if I'm going to have to pay for it with my taxpayer dollars, I feel like I ought to have something to say about it. And so if you get into a situation where you've got an entity of public broadcasting that wants to engage in political speech that's agenda-driven, that to me is excessive, where they're receiving taxpayer money without the consent of the taxpayer to support speech that they might find offensive. And it's a two-way street. You know, if liberals find conservative radio offensive, they can turn it off. But most of the time, where you see, you know, conservative radio is not, it almost exclusively operates in the commercial space. Whereas things like NPR are subsidized, it creates an unfair dynamic. And yes, you can turn it off, but you can't turn off the revenue if that's part of how they're funded, and that is. They rely heavily on federal funds, and that's not the case for other broadcasters. And so I think there has to be some fairness there and an expectation of even-handed presentation of issues. And that's where I think people really kind of become a little bit disenchanted with the idea of funding public broadcasting and arts and humanities through federal tax dollars when they engage in the type of political action that is not supported on the other side, and other entities have to go out and support themselves commercially.
Representative Rick Crawford, thank you for your time, and thank you for this extended session, and also thanks to the listeners for being able to submit these questions on our Facebook page at KASU Public Radio, and you can keep doing that, and I think it definitely helps to have listener questions to be able to kind of ask. So, Representative Crawford, thank you for those for your time, and thank you for answering those questions. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and let him go. And, of course, if you would like to hear that interview back again, you can. You can go to our website at kasu.org, and you can subscribe for the podcast, or you can hear that anytime. Also, we'll have it on demand at kasu.org as well.